Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Tower, a chronicle of climbing and controversy on Cerro Torre. By Kelly Cordes. Narrated by Bernardo De Paula. The world of dew is the world of dew, and yet. Kobayashi Isa, 1763 to 1828. Part 1. Chapter 1. Lost Time. The howling Patagonian wind calmed to a whisper. The afternoon sun beat down, and I blinked hard against the haze of exhaustion, the kind of blink where a black screen seems to linger behind your eyelids, and you wonder how much time you lost. I stared past thousands of feet of golden granite disappearing beneath me. A vertical mile below flowed the Torre Glacier, bending, cracked, cracking, growing and shrinking with the years. At its terminus, only a short way down valley, it calves into Laguna Torre and flows into rivers feeding forests and rolling pampas. Scattered estancias dot a landscape where not long ago pumas and wild horses roamed. A giant condor soared overhead, riding the thermals. Sheep grazed on the barren grasslands that extend eastward to the Atlantic Ocean. 100 feet above, enormous structures of overhanging, aerated ice, vestiges of Patagonia's brutal storms, held guard over Cerro Torre's summit. They loomed like multi-ton sculptures pulled from a land of fairy tales, like whipped cream frozen in place, jutting wildly outward in gravity-defying wind-forged blobs. On the opposite side of the mountain, Cerro Torre faces the Hielo Continental, an Antarctic-like world comprising massive sheets of flat glacial ice that spill into the Pacific Ocean. Just before sunrise, 30-some hours earlier, we had started climbing. We raced up ephemeral ice beneath a serac, then weaved through gargoyles of rime. We fell short of the summit as the sun set and the wind roared, and we shivered away the night in a snow cave in the starlit blackness of Cerro Torre's upper crest. Come morning, we struggled over the summit and then started down the other side. Both of us carried only 10-pound backpacks, but we also carried fantasies, a dose of self-delusion, and a shred of hope. Without those, we'd have never left the ground. I blinked again, and my gaze returned across the landscape, from the distant pampas to the beech forest surrounding Laguna Torre, to the golden granite falling away beneath my feet, and then to the rusting engine block on which I stood, the only stance on Cerro Torre's head wall. A 150-pound gas-powered air compressor, a goddamn jackhammer lashed to the flanks of the most beautiful mountain on earth. Above and below ran an endless string of climbing bolts, ancient 2-inch pegs of metal drilled into the rock and spaced to be used like ladders, courtesy of the compressor and a man possessed that for 4 decades allowed passage up this impossible tower. The wind remained at a whisper. Exhaustion pulsed through my bones, and I stared into a clear cobalt sky and knew that we'd been lucky. Calm around Cerro Torre never lasts. Chapter 2. In the Beginning. For all of the spectacular images of dramatic mountains and coastlines, Patagonia is a largely barren, arid, and sparsely populated region covering 1 million square kilometers in southern Argentina and Chile. But over the course of the last 65 million years, erosion has worn away soft surrounding rock to reveal a compact cluster of granite spires just inland from the Pacific Ocean at 49 degrees south latitude. The Chaltén Massif juts from the earth like parallel rows of sharpened teeth. The massif and its surroundings embody a range of contrasts. The massive Hielo Continental, southern Patagonia ice cap, spans 240 miles north-south. Fjords snake inland from the Pacific only 30 miles to the west, while a few miles to the east, Vast grasslands and plains extend 200 miles to the Atlantic. Just south, giant lakes, Lago Viedma and Lago Argentino, 45 and 60 miles long, could be mistaken for seaways. A bit farther south, from the tip of the South American continent, 400 miles of ocean leads to Antarctica. The massif's location subjects it to ferocious oceanic weather. Cold air currents race across the narrow ice cap with little resistance, carrying moist air that coats the summits in rime ice. The Chaltén Massif comprises two parallel rows of north-south mountains, the Torrey Group and the Fitzroy Chain. The Torreys are bordered on the west by the ice cap, thus they bear the brunt of the incoming weather and acquire outrageous rime ice formations. The eastern aspects of the Torres drop precipitously into narrow glaciated valleys, then rise into the Fitzroy chain. Despite being in the same compact massif, sitting only 2.5 miles apart, these two mountain groups experience different conditions. The Fitzroy chain is usually considerably warmer and drier than the Torres. Continuing just east of the Fitzroy chain, in the narrow space between the mountains and the scrub brush pampas, flourishes a sanctuary for birds and mammals. Lenga and enyire trees, stout and strong against the ever-present wind, blend with calafate bushes and manzanillas that sit low to the ground with berries and thistles. The textured landscape alternates between sparse and dense forests. The weather and the rain shadow, where the town of El Chaltén sits, is often mild, breezy, a mix of sun and mist shifting and swirling every 30 seconds, while in the mountains, even contemplating climbing would be unthinkable. The wind up there lifts people off the ground and slams them down. The severity is almost beyond description. Many a would-be hard man has visited the massif thinking the tale's exaggerations, thinking they could deal with the notorious weather. Those foolhardy enough to harbor such illusions are rapidly sent scampering away. Unlike other storied alpine ranges, the challenges of Patagonia have nothing to do with altitude. Cerro Torres' summit rises to 10,262 feet. Fitzroy, the highest peak in the massif, rises 11,168 feet. Cerro Torre isn't like the perfect pyramidal mountains children draw. It's more sheer, more vertical, with summit mushrooms of snow and ice spilling beyond the walls below, resembling the top of a shaken champagne bottle, its exploding contents frozen in place. The general public calls vertical what devoted climbers call slabs. Vertical is, properly, 90 degrees, telephone pole vertical. Give it some wiggle room, and today's climbers might call vertical anything steeper than 80 or 85 degrees. Regardless, nowhere on Mount Everest or K2, not even on their hardest routes, nor on any of the alpine ice routes in the Alps, will you find such sustained vertical climbing as on Cerro Torre's easiest route. Cerro Torre's reputation was defined in a 1972 Mountain Magazine passage written by the editors. To climbers, it has come to represent the epitome of the unattainable icy peak, a savage fang of rock, falling away on all sides for thousands of feet, encrusted in a fragile armor of ice, and constantly battered by the winds and storms that sweep across the Patagonian ice cap. This diminutive yet formidable mountain has come to embody the whole spirit of superalpinism. Nobody knows for certain when the first humans laid eyes on Cerro Torre. The Tehuelche Indians roamed the land around today's El Chaltén for some 10,000 years before colonialization, disease, and assimilation rendered them virtually extinct. The plumes of wind and storm-driven clouds that have forever streamed from the top of Fitzroy led the Tehuelches to believe it was a volcano. The word Chaltel, or Chaltén, loosely translates to smoking mountain. Magellan's famous 16th-century voyage sparked interest among explorers in the region that we now call Patagonia, perhaps named after a mythical beast known as the Grand Patagon. Myths enshrouded the region, When Sir Francis Drake came to Patagonia in 1578 seeking riches but experiencing only atrocious storms, he blamed the natives. They built great fires and then cast upon them heaps of sand as a sacrifice to the devils. The first Westerner known to see the striking peaks of the Chaltén Massif was Spanish explorer Antonio de Viedma in 1782. One of his diary entries provides the earliest suggestion of Cerro Torre's name when he describes a prominent peak as una torre, a tower. In the centuries that followed, Europeans visited in increasing numbers, though the waterways held a constant threat from pirates. Charles Darwin sailed to Patagonia on British astronomer and explorer Robert Fitzroy's Beagle. Fitzroy spent nearly a decade mapping the coastal areas. Later, the Argentine explorer Francisco Perito Moreno named the massif's highest mountain in his honor. The Argentine spelling of the mountain became Fitzroy, overriding or ignoring the original Tehuelche name, Chaltén. By the late 1800s, settlers colonized the plains. The mountains, devoid of game and unsuitable for farming, were of little use. Gauchos tended their livestock on horseback and navigated at night by the stars of the Southern Cross. While nearby Tehuelche rock paintings date back some 5,000 years, it wasn't until the early 1900s that European settlers began living near the area we now call El Chaltén. A 1915-16 expedition led by Swiss Alfred Kolliker was the first to explore the massif, charting much of its southern and western portions and making several non-technical ascents of nearby peaks. His team published a book, which was later followed by a personal account from Kolliker. Knowledge spread slowly in those days. But with a significant and growing community of European immigrants in Argentina, it's no surprise that interest in exploring the massif arose among those not only in Buenos Aires, but also across the Atlantic. Starting in the 1930s, expeditionary interest grew, and along with it, competition to climb the area's peaks. One of the most influential European explorers, at least in terms of climbing, was the Italian missionary and devoted mountaineer, geographer, and photographer Alberto Maria de Agostini. He made the first of his multiple expeditions to the area in 1932. In 1937, an Italian team, led by the well-connected Count Aldo Bonacosa, made the first attempt on Cerro Fitzroy. In 1941, the genie was officially out of the bottle when De Agostini published his book, Andes Patagónicos. Quite naturally, it caught the eye of many top European alpinists. Inspired by De Agostini's images, a French team led by Guido Magnone and Lionel Terray made plans to attempt Fitzroy. According to rumor, Argentina's president was so excited by the publicity of such a feat that he offered them a helicopter to the summit. The climbers declined. Even back then, when siege-style expeditions were the norm, the idea was to actually climb the mountain. It was an early harbinger that would resonate years later on Cerro Torre, where use of technology would prompt questions about the difference between climbing a mountain and merely getting to the top. On February 2, 1952, Magnone and Terray stood on the summit of Fitzroy. They'd made an impressively rapid ascent, weaving up the line of least resistance along the cold south buttress. In the southern hemisphere, the sun warms the northerly aspects, while south faces remain shaded. Utilizing a minimal number of fixed ropes, their climb was a nod toward the future in an era of siege-style ascents. From the summit, Terray looked over at Cerro Torre and declared, "Now there's a mountain worth risking one's skin for." After their ascent of Fitzroy, Terray gave a presentation at the Italian Alpine Club branch in Buenos Aires, at which he mentioned seeing the most beautiful mountain in the world. Magnone and Terray publicly labeled Cerro Torre impossible, but their words only whetted the interest of the day's top alpinists. The challenge of the future was clear. Cesare Maestri, A young climber in the autonomous Trentino province of northern Italy was making a name for himself, soloing up and often back down some of the most daunting faces in the Dolomites, an incredible assortment of difficult routes up to 3,000 feet tall. Soloing, climbing alone, usually without a rope, was considered the mark of a loner, a characterization that fit Maestri's upbringing. His mother died when he was 7, and his father ran a traveling theater. The elder Maestri was condemned to death and hunted when the Nazis overtook Trento in World War II. He, as well as young Cesare, had sided with the Italian partisans against the Nazis and Mussolini's fascist movement. They fled to the plains of the Bologna region, where they wandered for a year until returning toward the end of the war. In post-war 1950s, climbers were celebrities in northern Italy, often recognized on the streets and featured in newspapers. Maestri's was a rags-to-riches story. He soon became known as Il Ragno delle Dolomiti, the spider of the Dolomites, for his free solos. On the occasions that he roped up with a partner, he insisted on leading every pitch. Cesare Maestri would follow nobody. His skill was as legendary as his determination. Climbing was his obsession. He trained, went to bed early, followed a strict diet. Climbing consumed him. "Even when I made love to a girl, I did it in the press-up position to strengthen my arms," he said. But Maestri was excluded from the large 1954 Italian K2 expedition. He was snubbed for reasons that remain unclear, but suggest expeditionary politics and his anarchistic mindset. He was denied the greatest honor an Italian climber could have at the time. Maestri responded by enchaining 13 peaks in the Brenta Dolomites, climbing both up and down, ropeless, totaling some 12,000 vertical feet, the same height from base camp to the summit of K2. Maestri completed this enchainment in a mere 16 hours. The feat made the news, and soon after, Cesarino Fava, a Trentino climber who'd emigrated to Buenos Aires after the war, saw a magazine spread featuring a photo of Maestri during his enchainment. Though Fava and Maestri were from nearby villages, they'd never met. Fava wrote Maestri a letter describing Cerro Torre. "Come here, you will find bread for your teeth," an Italian saying meaning a mountain worthy of your reputation. Of course, the beautiful and daunting Patagonian Tower, declared impossible by none other than Torre and Magnone, had already generated a buzz among the daring and competitive alpinists of the day. Maestri left Italy in late 1957 on a Cerro Torre expedition led by the renowned Trentino explorer and expedition veteran Bruno de Tassis. Fava met them in Buenos Aires and they headed south in early 1958. Around the same time, the Italian Alpine Club of Buenos Aires adventurer and Italian emigre Folco Doro Altan had already explored the ice cap 3 times. He provided a natural logistical link between the bewitching landscape of Patagonia and some of the top climbing talent on Earth back home in Italy. Doro Altan insisted that the original idea for attempting Cerro Torre, Fava had never been to Patagonia, and even for inviting Maestri, were his. As things played out, he invited the great alpinist Walter Bonatti, who invited Carlo Mauri. Bonatti and Mauri were from Italy's Lombardy region, though around that time Bonatti was moving west to Courmayeur, and frequently climbed together in the Grigna Spires near Lecco. They were two of the hottest climbers in Europe. In 1958, they would make what was, at the time, the hardest technical ascent in the Himalaya with their first ascent of Pakistan's 26,000 one-foot Gasher Broom 4. While the relationship between Doro Altan and Fava and their respective teams isn't perfectly clear, in Doro Altan's unpublished autobiography, he died in 1999, he describes the infighting and competition. Climbing was huge in Italy, and provincialism, extending to competition among expats, ran deep. Any climbers from 2 different parts of Italy would have been competing as if they were from different hemispheres, said Marcello Costa. Costa was 73 years old at the time we spoke, and an MD and neurophysiology researcher in Australia, was born and raised in Italy. He immigrated to Buenos Aires, where he explored the ice cap in the late 1950s, was a member of the Alpine Club, and became acquainted with Doro Altan and Fava. He remembers both men. Folco, Doro Altan, was the opposite of Cesarino, Fava. Folco was an ambitious, sophisticated entrepreneur, while Cesarino was an old-fashioned mountaineer, full of that pseudo-poetry of mountaineering that mixes morality of a good mountain treats well good people. When the two groups met in the shadow of the Chaltén Massif, it became apparent that there would be no joining of forces. Members from De Tassis's Trentino team, including Fava, had already made an aerial reconnaissance of Cerro Torre and planned to climb from the east side. Protected from the initial brunt of storms that rage off the Pacific to the west, the east side has a less hostile climate and has far easier logistics. Due to travel infrastructure, both teams would start from the east. Bonatti's team, however, would try to climb the west face. This would require a grueling 40-mile approach hike, crossing the north-south ridge of glaciated mountains into the full fury of the storms blasting across the ice cap. "The storms which burst over the mountain are terrifying," Bonatti wrote. "Sometimes gusts of wind laden with sleet and ice crystals reach the terrific velocity of 120 miles an hour and form permanent ice incrustations even under roofs and overhangs, which jut out further than one would imagine. The white and bluish ice which covers the rocks can reach thicknesses of over 10 feet, assuming fantastic and terrifying forms. Everything is of gigantic size and seems to hang miraculously in space." Bonatti and Mauri got about halfway up the icy west face. Along the way, they fixed ropes and camped at a prominent col just south of Cerro Torre. "Our surroundings were fantastic, though absolutely terrifying. We were optimistic, so much so that we didn't recognize that merely to reach the col we were already overcoming difficulties comparable to those on the most taxing climbs in the Western Alps," Bonatti wrote. Above the col, in the face of daunting terrain considered difficult and serious even by today's standards, Bonatti and Mauri valiantly climbed on, navigating around overhanging mushrooms of rime with painstaking techniques. They knew they had no chance. Still, they inched onward, periodically staring out to the vast emptiness of the ice cap. Above loomed 1,000 feet of significantly harder climbing. When they retreated, Bonatti said it was like waking from a dream and entering the real world. "We were beaten. We got back down to the col and stayed there, sitting down for a long time, in silence. Armed with knowledge of the mountain, they promised themselves they would return. In that spirit, they named the saddle where they sat the Col of Hope." At the same time, on the other side of the mountain, when they saw Cerro Torre up close, De Tassis prohibited his team from even attempting it, declaring, "The tower is a mountain impossible, and I do not want to endanger anyone's life. Accordingly, in my capacity as leader of the expedition, I forbid you to attack the tower." Maestri remained undeterred. The proud spider of the Dolomites had envisioned a potential line up the lower east face of Cerro Torre to a prominent col, then continuing up the north face to the summit. He began planning his return. Later, he would bestow a name upon this col, the Col of Conquest, a pointed dig at Bonatti and Mauri's Col of Hope. "In the mountains," Maestri wrote, "there is no such thing as hope, only the will to conquer. Hope is the weapon of the weak." Chapter 3. Tony, Tony, Tony. It was February 2013, and raindrops darted intermittently through the air, carried by the only constant in the village of El Chaltén, Argentina, the wind. The Patagonian wind so scours the landscape that in some regions people call it la escoba de Dios, the broom of God. Melodic sounds of Latina singers floated through the air in Patagonicus Restaurant, one of El Chaltén's most popular spots, owned by one of the town's prominent families. Archival photos, origin stories, hang from its walls. I sat at a rustic wooden table, sipped my espresso, and waited for Cesar Fava. Cesar's father, Cesarino, is the man who wrote the letter to Cesare Maestri, inviting him to attempt the mountain that would provide bread for his teeth. The elder Fava died in 2008 at the age of 87. Maestri, born in 1929, he lived in a mountain village in Italy up until his death in 2021. In his later years, he refused to talk about the mountain that made him famous. I wanted to talk with Cesar because he is one of the last living links to Cerro Torre's early complex history. I wanted to ask him about 1959. After his failure in early 1958, Maestri returned in 1959. With the elder Fava's help, he and Austrian climbing ace Tony Egger made the first ascent of the tower previously deemed impossible. Egger and Maestri's rapid climb of Cerro Torre's daunting north face was such a quantum leap in standards that serious alpinists then considered it the greatest ascent of all time. But Egger died on their descent, and questions arose about the veracity of Fava and Maestri's story. I got up and wandered over to stare at the photos that line Patagonicus's walls. Dozens of grainy black and whites of Fava and Maestri's late 1950s expeditions. Photos of everything, that is, but the actual climb of 1959. The images depict a different world, another time within the same place. My mind short circuits at the audacity of even trying the north face of Cerro Torre back then. It was astronomically harder than anything yet climbed. It took 47 years and dozens of attempts by the finest alpinists of each succeeding generation before another party would successfully climb Cerro Torre from the north. In those old photos, Maestri looks comfortable, happy, at peace. But in 2012, at the age of 82, he said, "If I could have a magic wand, I would erase Cerro Torre from my life." A woman's voice pulled me from my reverie. "Cesar will be here in a minute," she said. I went back to my chair, opened my notebook, and took another sip of espresso. "Hi, I'm Cesar," he said as he approached my table. He was 46 years old, appeared fit, stood 5'8", a few inches taller than his famous father, Cesarino. They share similar features: wavy hair, strong cheekbones, sturdy build. Within minutes, Cesar's eyes sparkled and grew wide, his face glowing as he reminisced about the mountains and the past, simple times, days of passion. "My father always tell me, follow the passion." His father grew up a peasant, one of 12 children in the Trentino province of war-torn Italy. After serving 5 years in the war, like so many Italians, he left the homeland, landing in Buenos Aires, where he worked odd jobs between trips to the mountains, eventually earning a living as a street vendor. Along with other immigrants, he founded the Argentine branch of the Italian Alpine Club and became a prominent conduit to Italian climbers, especially those visiting the Andes from Trentino. A simple, hardworking, and humble man known for his sincerity and charm, Cesarino Fava balanced a tireless work ethic with his passion for the mountains and later the demands of raising a family. As with so many connected to the elder Fava, Maestri, and old school Trentino climbing, Cesar's reverence for the past seems ingrained in his DNA. Cesar recalled his first trip to this area in 1983, when as a teenager, he helped carry gear on one of his father's expeditions. There was no town, no bridge, and they rode horses across the river and camped in the beech forests. Those days were modern compared to 1959, but...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?